Welcome back to The Deep Dive. Today we're getting into something truly, well, mind-bending. Neuroplasticity. We've got some fantastic sources here, giving us a really deep look at this idea that our brains aren't static, you know, hardwired, but can actually change.
That's right, adapt based on experience.
Exactly. And our mission today, our deep dive, is to explore how this happens according to these sources. Not just one big idea, but looking at the different levels, from the tiniest connections right up to whole brain regions and, you know, how it plays out across our lives.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
And when we talk neuroplasticity, the sources define it pretty clearly. It's the brain's capacity neurons, neural networks, to basically change their connections, change how they behave. And this happens in response to all sorts of things, new information, sensory input, just normal development, or even damage or dysfunction.
So the core idea is plastic moldable.
Precisely. Not rigid like, say, concrete. It's adaptable. It can reorganize, learn. It's a fundamental property.
Okay, so let's unpack that then. Starting really small, what's happening right down there at the connections between neurons? The synapses.
Right. At that microscopic level, it really is all about the synapse, that little gap where neurons communicate.
Mm-hmm.
We can measure something called synaptic strength.
Synaptic strength. What's that in, like, simple terms?
Think of it as how strong the connection is. Like, how much impact does the signal from the first neuron have on the second one?
Okay.
And synaptic strengthening is basically anything that turns up the volume on that connection, making it more effective. One of the big mechanisms our research highlights is long-term potentiation, or LTP.
LTP. Heard of that.
Yeah, it's fundamental. Basically, if you stimulate a synapse repeatedly in a certain way, its response gets stronger over time. It becomes more sensitive. The sources often mention these classic experiments, you know, in the hippocampus, and where they stimulate one pathway a lot, and it responds way more strongly than another pathway that hasn't been used as much. And LTP is really tightly linked to learning and memory. It's like the more you use a pathway, the stronger it gets. Practice makes, well, stronger synapses.
So using it turns up the volume. Can you turn it down too?
Oh, absolutely. That's crucial too. The flip side is long-term depression, or LTD. Under different patterns of stimulation, the synaptic response can actually get weaker. It becomes less sensitive.
So you need both, strengthening and weakening.
Exactly. For the brain to be flexible, it needs to be able to fine-tune connections in both directions. It's not just about adding strength, but also about maybe reducing noise or dialing back connections that aren't as important anymore. Essential for learning what matters.
Mm-hmm.
And there's another mechanism mentioned, quite interesting. Denervation supersensitivity.
Denervation supersensitivity. What's that?
Okay, imagine some neurons in a pathway get damaged or die off. The neuron on the receiving end, the postsynaptic one, can actually react by developing more receptors for the neurotransmitter.
Trying to catch whatever signal is left.
Precisely. It becomes super sensitive to the reduced input it's getting, trying to compensate for the loss. The research notes this was seen early on in muscle tissue, but it happens between neurons too. Although, you know, there are limits. It can't compensate if the damage is too severe.
Wow. Okay, so even at that tiny synapse level, there's strengthening, weakening, compensating. It's complex. But the sources also talk about bigger changes, right? Not just one connection, but pathways. Something about gardening.
Ah, yes.
Yeah.
The gardening analogy. That refers to synaptic pruning.
Pruning. Like trimming bushes.
Kind of, yeah. It's the brain's way of getting rid of synapses that aren't being used much or aren't efficient, streamlining the network. And the sources lay out this really interesting developmental timeline for it. You get this huge explosion of synapse formation early on, like from before birth up to maybe age two. Then from about 2 to 10 years old, there's this phase of really rapid pruning. The brain is refining its wiring.
So it makes way more connections than it needs initially.
Exactly. Then it shapes itself based on experience.
Yeah.
This pruning actually continues through adolescence and into the early 20s, especially in the prefrontal cortex, the part involved in planning and decision making. It seems to kind of level off in the late 20s.
Interesting. Is there a good example of that?
Yeah. The development of the visual cortex is a classic one mentioned. Synapse numbers peak there around 8 months or so. Then, as the baby starts actually seeing and processing visual information, the pathways getting used are strengthened. But synapses in that area that might have initially been, say, linked to hearing or touch, if they aren't getting visual input, they get weakened and eventually pruned away in people with sight.
So the brain is literally sculpting itself based on the senses it's using.
Precisely. Tailoring itself to the environment and experience. And the sources do touch on how researchers are looking into what happens if this pruning doesn't quite go according to plan. There's ongoing research, for example, looking at potential links between maybe too much pruning, especially during adolescence, and conditions like schizophrenia.
Overpruning.
Yeah. And conversely, some research is exploring if maybe underpruning, keeping too many connections, might be related to conditions like autism or Savant syndrome. Different wiring, different processing.
Mm-hmm.
But it's really important to stress, as the sources do, that these are areas of active research. These links are being investigated, not definitively stated as like the sole cause. It's complex.
Right, right. Okay, so we've gone from synapses getting stronger or weaker to whole connections getting pruned. Now, this is where it gets, I think, really wild.
Mm.
The idea that the brain can adapt on an even bigger scale. Whole regions, entire systems changing, especially after something like damage.
Absolutely. This brings us to some broader concepts. One is adult neurogenesis.
Making new neurons. I thought that stopped after childhood.
That was the old thinking for a long time. But the research is clear now. We do keep generating new functional neurons as adults. Now, it's not happening everywhere. It seems restricted to specific areas in mammals. But a key one is the hippocampus, which is crucial for learning and memory. So new neurons are being born and integrated in important regions throughout life.
That's pretty cool. What else happens at this bigger scale?
Well, there's an older theory called equipotentiality. This came partly from early studies, like lesioning parts of rat brains. The basic idea was that if a part of a brain region was damaged, the remaining intact parts could potentially take over the function of the whole region.
So any part could do the job of the whole thing.
That was the gist of the theory, yeah.
Yeah.
The source defines it as any portion compensating for incomplete damage. However,
there's a however.
Yeah, the source does note there's some uncertainty about how widely accepted that specific theory is today.
Why is that? More recent findings.
Possibly. I mean, while the brain is incredibly adaptable, we also know there's a lot of specialization. So the idea that any random bit of a region can perfectly perform all its functions might be a bit too strong. Compensation definitely happens, but maybe not quite like that original theory proposed.
Okay, so what's a more current idea about large-scale compensation?
A concept that comes up a lot is vicariation. This is where one brain area or even a whole system steps up to compensate for the loss or damage of another area or system.
Ah, like teamwork. One area picks up the slack for another.
Exactly. And the sources give some great examples. After a stroke that affects movement on one side, the undamaged hemisphere can actually strengthen connections and reorganize to help regain some control over the paralyzed side.
Wow.
Or after a traumatic brain injury, the brain might form new pathways to support functions like memory or learning that were affected. And think about sensory loss. People with hearing loss might show enhanced activity and connections in their visual cortex, becoming better at lip reading or sign language.
Using the visual part for language input.
Right. And conversely, individuals with vision loss often develop heightened abilities in hearing and touch, with those sensory areas becoming more dominant or reorganized. The brain repurposes resources.
That ability to repurpose is just amazing.
It really is. And one more related concept the sources mention is dyschisis.
Dyschisis. Sounds complicated.
It's an interesting one. It refers to a temporary loss of function in a brain region. But here's the twist. That region isn't damaged itself. It loses function because an area it's connected to is damaged.
Like a ripple effect or shock.
Kind of like a functional shockwave, yeah. It disrupts connected circuits temporarily. The sources say it usually resolves over time. You might see it as temporary problems after a stroke or brain surgery, or even a concussion affecting areas distant from the actual injury.
Do we know why that happens?
The exact mechanism is still a bit fuzzy, honestly.
Mm.
It's thought to involve temporary changes in synaptic activity or neurotransmitter levels affecting those connected distant areas. Still quite mysterious in detail.
Okay, so we've got all these mechanisms. Synapses changing strength, pathways getting pruned, whole regions compensating or even being generated anew. What does this actually look like in real life? The sources had some incredible examples, didn't they?
They did. And linking the mechanisms to the examples really brings it home. Take the London taxi drivers.
Ah, yes, the knowledge.
Exactly. They have to learn this incredibly complex map of London. And studies show that as they gain experience, the posterior part of their hippocampus, the bit involved in spatial navigation, actually gets larger, more gray matter volume.
And their brains physically change from learning the streets.
That's what the evidence suggests. And interestingly, sometimes the anterior part of their hippocampus might shrink slightly, perhaps because they rely less on other types of memory strategies.
Mm-hmm.
The key thing was this showed significant structural change happening in adults purely from learning and experience.
That's fantastic. What else?
Second language acquisition is another great example. Learning a new language, especially proficiently, is linked to increased gray matter density in a part of the brain called the left inferior parietal cortex. And the studies found the amount of change correlates with proficiency. Also, interestingly, it correlates negatively with the age of acquisition.
Meaning learning earlier leads to more change.
Potentially higher density, yeah. It underlines that while plasticity is lifelong, there might be sensitive periods or at least age-related differences in the degree or type of structural change.
Makes sense. And the visual impairment examples were striking too.
Oh, definitely. Visual impairment compensation is a prime example of cross-modal plasticity. The visual cortex, normally for sight, gets recruited for other senses in blind individuals' touch, hearing, sometimes even smell.
The brain repurposes that processing power.
It does. And the research notes differences, too. People blind from birth often have a thicker visual cortex. The thinking is maybe they didn't prune away those non-visual inputs to that area as much during early development.
So they might have a stronger basis for that cross-modal takeover.
Possibly leading to stronger cross-plasticity, yeah. And it's not just congenital blindness. Even sighted adults who learn Braille show their visual cortex becoming active when reading by touch.
Mm-hmm.
Plus, you see structural changes, gray matter, myelin-related measures in sensory areas. So we see both functional shifts, like with fMRI, and structural changes.
Visual cortex reading Braille. That's just amazing repurposing.
It truly is. And then there are the really dramatic case studies the sources mentioned.
Like Cheryl Schultz.
Right, Cheryl Schultz. She lost her sense of balance because of damage to her vestibular system. Her brain learned to use signals from sensors on her head, fed through electrodes on her tongue to restore her balance.
Through her tongue?
Yeah. It shows the brain can learn to interpret completely novel sensory inputs. That's incredible compensatory plasticity. Or consider the six-year-old boy who had a significant part of his right hemisphere removed, including visual areas, due to seizures.
A huge part of his brain removed.
Yes. And his left hemisphere largely took over the visual functions. Remarkably, his overall cognitive abilities, his IQ, remained intact or even improved slightly after the surgery.
That level of reorganization is hard to fathom.
It is, and it's often even more dramatic earlier in life. There's the case of Maura Lieb, who had a hemispherectomy removal of her damaged left hemisphere as an infant. Her remaining right hemisphere took over functions typically handled by the left, like speech and motor control for the right side of her body.
So the younger the brain, the more potential for this massive reorganization.
These cases strongly suggest that yes, especially in infancy and early childhood, the potential for large-scale vicariation for one hemisphere to take on the roles of the other seems extraordinary. It highlights this incredible redundancy and adaptability.
It definitely seems like some parts of the brain are more adaptable or better at bouncing back than others, though. Is that right?
That seems to be the case, yes. Based on the sources, there are regional differences. Some areas appear generally more plastic, meaning their circuits change more readily with normal learning and experience. The hippocampus, visual cortex, motor cortex, and prefrontal cortex often come up. Which makes sense, given their roles in memory, perception, action, and thinking things that need constant updating.
And recovery after damage.
Well, the hippocampus has that neurogenesis potential we talked about, which helps. And the motor cortex shows pretty good recovery potential with rehabilitation after things like stroke, suggesting it's quite good at reorganizing for movement control.
But not all areas recover equally well.
Apparently not. The sources suggest areas like the visual cortex and the prefrontal cortex might have a lower probability of recovery from very extensive damage. While they are plastic for learning, maybe they're highly specialized, complex functions are just harder for other brain regions to fully replicate if a large part is lost, compared to, say, the hippocampus generating new cells or the motor cortex reorganizing for simpler movements.
And are some areas just generally less plastic?
The research points that way, too. Some regions seem less plastic in terms of, for example, having lower rates of neurogenesis or perhaps less dramatic structural change in adulthood under normal conditions. Areas like the basal ganglia, involved in coordinating movement and forming habits, and the primary auditory cortex doing the initial sound processing, are sometimes mentioned. Maybe their functions are more stable or less dependent on constant large-scale remodeling.
So it's a bit of a mixed bag across the brain.
Definitely. And that leads to a really important point the sources emphasize, managing expectations about neuroplasticity.
Right. It's amazing, but it's not magic, is it?
Exactly. It's incredibly powerful, but it's not a cure-all. The research confirms plasticity is generally most active when we're young, especially in early childhood. That's when the brain is doing the most dramatic wiring and pruning.
But it doesn't just stop.
Absolutely not. And this is crucial. Sources are clear. It continues throughout our whole life, especially for learning, adapting to experiences, forming memories. Those neurons and networks retain their ability to change. Your brain is still plastic.
Okay, that's the good news. What's the limitation?
The limitation is that, as we've discussed, some areas are less plastic than others, and recovery from damage, while possible and sometimes remarkable, is often limited, especially if the injury is very severe or widespread. The brain's compensatory abilities are amazing, but they operate within biological constraints.
This has been such a fascinating journey. We've gone from, you know, those tiny adjustments at the synapse.
LTP and LTD.
Right. All the way through pruning pathways based on what we do and experience.
You use it or lose its principle, essentially.
And up to these huge reorganizations, compensating for injury or reshaping from intense training. It really does throw out that old idea of the brain being fixed after childhood.
It absolutely does. Huh. It paints a picture of the brain as this incredibly dynamic, constantly evolving system. It's always sculpting itself in response to life.
And seeing those real-world examples, the taxi drivers, the language learners, people overcoming sensory loss or even massive brain injury, it just shows how your brain, the listener's brain, is doing this all the time, adapting to everything you experience.
Constantly learning, constantly changing, even if subtly.
So here's something to think about, building on all this. If experience, learning, focused practice can physically change our brains through these mechanisms, strengthening connections, pruning others, shifting functions, even changing structure, what does that really imply about the potential we all have through deliberate effort and learning to shape our own minds and abilities, not just when we're kids, but right through our entire lives? Definitely something to keep exploring.